Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Buddham dhammam sangham nissāmi. So today is the, as you're well aware, the anniversary of the passing away of Rinpo Cha. And this is commemorated in Thailand, in Wat Pa Phong. We call it Acharya Puja. Acharya means teacher, puja, celebration, honouring, salutation, rising up to recollect and recall and bring to mind and dwell upon the qualities and the effect of a teacher, and particularly, of course, Ajahn Chah. Not just the. So it's important to bear in mind this is not really about an Ajahn Chah cult, though it can seem like it. It's recognizing this, whoever this person was, taught a lot, and but also brought forth a lot from people, his presence and what he did, what he was and what he wasn't, acted on people, on a large range of people. It touched something in them, it drew things out of them, and it quelled things in them. It brought forth strengths they didn't know they had. And it restrained and corrected tendencies they thought they were stuck with. And this wasn't just through information, not do this, do that, but actually just through presence and by engaging, which Bodhisattva did to an enormous degree. He was always engaging. Well, that's what people said, that's what I noticed. I wasn't with him for long. Yeah. But if Bodhisattva was around and you were around, you knew he was going to get you. Somehow. He'd check you out and start finding some way to kind of get in there, poke, tease, tickle, prod, and there was nobody was safe. it wasn't vicious, it was generally that started with a little tease or a smile, maybe just ignore you for a while and then kind of bring you in a bit. And then kind of, what do you think about that? And anything like that? So it's very engaging. And so this quality of engagement, you know, would actually get right to where people were at, and often in different number of ways, depending where they were at, actually. And that was the sort of rather marvellous quality. He was so dexterous, and reading or sensing, or his jitta was, where a person was at, he'd find some way of just cause him to look at it, or challenge it, or bring it out, or encourage it. You know, and so it's he actually worked on people. You know, and as individuals, and also as a group. So you know, everyone who was with him got something personal directed right at them. You know, of various kinds. Various qualities, and something they remembered, maybe something checked. You know. This is a powerful teacher. it could be a number of things. I mean, Ajahn Yanadhava mentioning one of his stories was when he was at Wat Bapong, he was, you know, they always had to hand out the food. So what would happen is you'd have to leave your bowl, and two monks would just get up, you see. So if you're one of the monks who's allocated, you had to get up and go along the line of monks and just throw food in the bowl. So monks would sit there and a bunch of food gets slopped in the bowl, and that's what you got, you know. And then, so if you left your bowl, then you just got, there's people tip whatever, get tipped into your bowl. If you're sitting with your bowl, you can kind of put your hand up and say, no, don't want that one thing, you know, you could pass on something. But if you're serving, you've got whatever got thrown in your bowl, so it could be a complete tip. And so this was, he'd do that, and he found out one monk wasn't cooperating, so he was getting more and more annoyed with this monk for not behaving properly, getting really angry, and he was seething with irritation at this person not being cooperative, and then coming back from the arms round muttering to himself, and he met Ajahn Chah getting a big smile. What are you doing? And he felt his heart lift. And, oh, you can come round my kuti. So he came round to the kuti in the evening and massaging Ajahn Chah's feet, which was considered a great honour. He was feeling very happy, delighted, and then suddenly his foot lifted and kicked him and knocked him over. What's happening? He says, see, when somebody disappoints you, get annoyed, and you have a good time, you get happy. Don't get caught up with what people do. Wake up. don't get infected with what people do. Of course, in words it hasn't quite got the impact. But in some sense, it's like a presence that really just grabs and holds and directs. So you could do, so it was that kind of teaching, very direct. There was a story of a monk I met, he said he'd been full of all kinds of doubts about what to do and what he's practicing, how much he'd do meditation, and was it really going to work for Westerners, and perhaps, you know, Western conditioning, he should do something else, because his Thai sister was kind of very much for Thais and insight, and maybe Burma would be better. So he went over to see, he was staying at Wat Banana Chat, he went over to see Ajahn Chah with his head full of his questions, what to do. He went to Ajahn Chah's kuti. Ajahn Chah was sweeping around the kuti. Ajahn Chah looks at him, throws him a broom, said, sweeping's better than talking. Sweep, so sweeping around. He did that for a few hours. The sun's going down, walk back to the Wat Banana Chat. You know, 2 hour walk or something. So he gets to leave, so he puts the broom down, he goes around to pay respects to Ajahn Chah. As he kneels down, Ajahn Chah grabs him by the shoulder and says, look, whatever you're doing, just do that, and don't keep thinking about it, doubting it. Very direct, you know, whatever you're in, just do that, stop wondering whether you should be, could be, whether it's right. Just do it. Do that. So it's a very direct approach. And this is, you know, so of course I didn't start my monastic life with Ajahn Chah. You know, I'd been to India looking for some sort of teacher, but I couldn't really get into teachers. They seem so, the gurus seem so much into themselves, and you have to be completely devoted to some guru. I can't do that. So I found that somebody in Thailand, an English monk, who was teaching meditation. Oh, okay. So this is very much like learn a particular thing. So information, how to do it, here's how to do it, this is what you do, do it. Teacher, okay. Found a place where I his monastery where I could do it. So I did it, and he was a teacher. So meditation is like learning French or something like that. You go and give your class, you do your practice, and then he comes back, how are you doing? Okay, fine, right, good, with more of this, and so forth. So that to me was what a teacher was. Until I met Ajahn Sumedho, who happened by chance, and this person wasn't giving any information. He wasn't holding anything back, he just was not interested in information. He didn't do information. He did presence. So it was rather coincidental how I happened to meet him. Just by circumstances turned out that way, and he brought me into his presence, and it was just this sense of presence. And it was quite calm, open. And the presence is like just this big open door that you could walk into. There was a space you could walk into. It was convivial, calm, steady, confident, open, and you just walked into this space. And there was plenty of room in it. There's a lot of space in it. Well, this is different. No information, no particular how to do it. Asking how I was doing, you know, interested in my welfare, and then the sense of, oh, this is different. So, circumstances eventually, I felt he was going to England, gave me that. So when I had to go to England because my father passed away, then I thought I'd go and check him out, because I was pretty much at my wit's end trying to handle all this stuff. Because I had no support in trying to handle my father's affairs and my mother's bereavement. So I went down to see him, and then he was knocked on the door, and he opened the door, and it's the same like he opened the door, it's like he opened himself. And you could walk in. Welcome, come in. For that same quality. It's only a small house. But he had a huge, open, comfortable presence that was not frightening or threatening or intimidating, just open and warm. And you go in there and you think, oh, this is rather pleasant. And he had a couple of other monks with him, Anando and Viradhamma. Ananda was an American, and he'd been a bit of a street kid, and then he'd been a sergeant, marine sergeant in Vietnam, got a bit of his head blown off with a bullet, and he got then shot in the back when they were lifting him out. So he'd been through the wars, then he'd been a bit, after he got, left the army, he was kind of just living playboy life on his pension. Then he met Ajahn Sumedho and he became a monk. So streetwise kid, really, and pretty snappy and and good at orders. He was a sergeant. Viradhamma, a Canadian, who was kind of a counterfoil to Ananda, because he'd always be able to kind of give a slightly ironic remark that would tend to get Nando to calm down. He was getting a little bit too much, he'd undercut him. So these two guys were playing each other off, and they weren't particularly happy stuck in this house in Hampstead. And then we found out that Ajahn Chah was coming over. And so I've met Ajahn Sumedho, and this is Ajahn Chah, Ajahn Sumedho's teacher. Ajahn Sumedho is pretty impressive. What's his teacher going to be like? I don't know, But what one heard was very strict and very tight, very strict on Vinaya. And when I'd been a monk, I hadn't had any Vinaya training. They just taught meditation. He said, meditate, just do what everybody else is doing. was the basic system. Well, unfortunately, I didn't get into too much mischief, but I hadn't really. I got lots and lots of offences because there was no training. So I felt pretty not up to scratch, you know. And then this strict Vinaya masters had come over and would give me a complete grilling, you know, a roasting for my offences. So I don't know what this is going to be like. But then we had to go to the airport to meet Ajahn Chah, and then he came and he had this another huge Westerner behind him. Prabhakara was a big guy who'd been a captain in Vietnam, helicopter captain, so he'd been in the wars too. He's a big, huge guy. There's this little fellow in front of him with a walking stick. But the little fellow in front felt bigger than the big guy behind him. It was extraordinary. Because, you know, visually you could see he was definitely quite a small person. But it was a sense of complete ease and confidence, like he was on top of the world. On top of it all. He's kind of rolling out on top of it all. And that completely in his element. Even though it was a Heathrow airport, he didn't speak English. Yeah, and he looked completely at home. In fact, looked more at home in Britain than most British people do. He looked like he totally belonged here and was completely comfortable with it. And that was pretty impressive. And then as soon as he came in, all the monks who came, they all hit the floor, you know. And then suddenly these captains and sergeants were all just like 10-year-old boys. And, oh, John, you know. And not fearful, just incredibly tender. Like their long lost father had come home to see them. They were just so grateful. And it was so, you know, what's happening here? You know, this is not some strict discipline. This is someone, they obviously love. Like a beloved father who's come home to give them presents or something. And they're just kind of all soft and you know, it's a. Okay, so follow this. And he came and stayed with us in the Hampstead Vihara. And then he went to, for about a month, he went to America. And then he came back and spent another few weeks in Britain. So that was it. But during that time, he'd be in the Vihara, Hampstead Vihara, and there'd just be people coming. And he would just, he'd have a translator. Either the Ajahn Sumedho or this other big monk, Prabhakara, would be doing the translating because he'd wear them out, because he'd just go on 6 hours straight. And eventually one translator would just conk out to get the other one in. He'd start at 6 and go until 2, easy. 6 in the evening, go until 2, just riffing off people and rapping with people and teasing people and winding people up, including the translators. You have a go at them, you know, make fun of their translations or and whether they're translating it right or not. Because after a while, he could probably tell they were getting tired, so he'd talk for 5 minutes and they'd give a 10-second translation. Do it right, good. So he wouldn't let them get off, and so that they would wear out and have to, you know. And it's just this tremendous energy giving out. And it was like, and you could sit there and watch him. For some people, it was like he was kind of, you know, reaching out and messing their hair, you know, just teasing them up a little bit. And some people, were just poking him gently in the ribs. Some people, would give a quick slap on the wrist. All not physically. That was what his energy was doing. You could feel it. And most of the time, and a lot of the time, it was just this kind of. The quality of his voice, as you know, Thai is a tonal language, there's a lot of cadence in it, up and down. But his was like, he could warble like a nightingale. His voice would go up and trill, and it would sink down like a water buffalo. And just this amazing range of sounds and grunts and tweets he'd come out with, guttural sounds, and just listening to this melody. with smiles and humour and pointing finger, and this evocation of a quality just riveting and directly turning this on to people, engaging with people, pulling them in and brightening them up. And when he was, by and large, you know, it was all very jocular. The general mood you had was fun. He was having fun. Yeah. He was having fun. And in the fun there'd be slightly teasing points that, you know, with a bit of a, you know, making fun of people in a quiet way, and tremendous energy. And he'd give the talk, and he'd reach different people. The Anagarika, Jerry, who did the painting of him, he's a brilliant artist, but you can see that amount of detailed attention, a very, very critical mind. You know, you see that quality. It took 2 years working on that pastel. So very, very sharp. And at one point, he got it almost finished and didn't like it and rubbed it out, started again. Very critical, very self-critical, highly critical, and he'd smoke. He was rolled up cigarettes and he'd smoke, like a chimney smoke, and all that. To get this kind of intensity to it. So when Ajahn Chah came to Britain, Ajahn Chah, he would get Jerry to roll him cigarettes, they'd sit down and smoke together. So he kind of brought Jerry in from this very critical person to feeling he was, Ajahn Chah would go and kind of emulate and move over to where he was at, you know, talk, you know, smoke cigarettes together in the garden and tease him a bit. That's kind of this sense of different people, reach different people in different ways. And there's something giving that amount of presence. And so it was always pretty warm, yeah. And certainly myself, I was kind of looking at it slightly on the edge of all this, thinking, I'm trying to keep my head down, as it were, and I didn't want to get worked over. And he kind of look around, he obviously noticed, but he wouldn't. Yeah. And then one day I was in the, we had to take his luggage to Oakenholt. I was there with Babakaro in the back seat. So the car stopped, Ajahn Chah got out, walked into the little cottage, and so I had to carry his bags in. So I carried his bags into his room, started putting them down, about to turn around to run out, and then you got the rest. Oh, yes, pulled around, not physically, because energy come out and grab and you turn around and sit there. And it just started, it's like, my time was pretty minimal, and his English was equally minimal. He must have sat for at least an hour, you know, in talking, just the sound of his voice rolling over. And the facial gestures and the body language, and I'm going, you know, it's all warm, fun, encouraging, little phrases I could pick up, you know, very, very simple Dhamma, very simple basic stuff, you know, it wasn't profound, it was the quality, it wasn't the information, it was the sense of presence, and it was reaching out and drawing you in, and obviously feeling for myself, you know, actually filling me up with a feeling of warmth and welcome and confidence, because that's what I needed. Other people would be given a push them back. And in that sense, you know, this is different. This is not information. His teaching in many ways is very simple. If you look at it in the books, it's very simple. You know, it's basic, but the presence. And so, you know, then bringing things out of you. And it certainly wasn't about, you know, trying to be worshipped. It was about filling you up, reaching your citta and sensing what was needed, and trying to, those who needed restraint, he'd give restraint. Those who needed to be made to just stop thinking, he'd stop it. Those who needed to be brought forward, he'd bring them forward. Do that, reading that. And this is different. Engagement. And engage with his own heart. It wasn't about belittling people. It was just, if people needed that, that's what he'd do. But it wasn't, he wasn't getting personal advantage out of it. And if people would push back, he would quite enjoy that. And I remember saying to Ajahn Viradhana, oh, you know, monks here, you just sit around drinking tea and chatting all day. You're only 20% monks. Viradhana said, well, it's better than 0%. Ajahn Chah, well, that was pretty good. Ajahn pushed back, you know. Because he wanted the people, you know, to actually get their own strength. Not just to become, yes sir, yes sir, and follow blindly, but to actually get their own strength. And if that meant challenging him, he was fine with that. And it's extraordinary when you go to Thailand, because they'd never seen this smiling Ajahn Chah, by and large. All the statues, I mean, Thailand's Ajahn Chah seemed like very still and stern. And in Thailand, they were scared a lot of the time. The Thai monks, because he could be extremely strong and and strict, because it seems that one felt that's what they needed. Particularly when you've got a group of 50 or 60 men, or some of them just village lads, and they needed restraint, and he would put it on. Westerners, we didn't need restraint. We were already so uptight already. We need loosening, so he did that. And it was interesting to see he had all these different qualities. And that seems to be why you have 300 branch monasteries and so many different kinds of disciples, and they all respect and got something personal to respect that. And the general theme of the teaching, and just Sumedha's teaching, is also very simple in many respects as a verbal structure. But it would just be repeated and reiterated. Often you get the phrase or theme, you come back again, and engage, and again. And the point of it, of all this stuff, was your sankharas, your mental constructions were running out in this way or that way, and the teacher would just stop that mental structure and put your heart somewhere else, put your jitta somewhere else. You know, just like you see a person training a puppy or something, puppy's running away, pick it up, put it there, run through it, do it again. And that's what these teachers did. You know, your mind would be running out this direction, so, no, put it there. And after a while, you run out there again, so, no, put it there. You'd run out again, put it there, and more emphatically, until eventually your mind stayed there, it didn't run out. So that, and somebody willing to do that, and Ajahn Chah did that 10, 12 hours a day, every day, at least. He'd be up receiving guests and go on until midnight at least. Just whoever came, he'd do that. Pick him up, put this one up, pick him up, put him there. Okay, this one there. And you've got tremendous energy to do that. And it's Mio, again, you know, when first range retreated, Okunoi gave at least one talk a day, every day, for the nine, whatever it was, the 90 days. And it was pretty much same theme, slightly different qualities to it. It was like every one of them was just wherever you go into some tangle or another, getting stuck in something, getting embedded in something, just pick it up. And the next day, you know, somebody got in an argument or was getting irritated at it. Or just getting stuck in some view or opinion. It's always like, you know, letting go, anicca, impermanent, don't hang on. And then you find another way to hang on. So I say it again, over and over again. The basic theme was always that your conditioned reactions, your conditioned mental structures are running out to create your own personal world, and the teacher would just stop, and stop, and just, so, you know, and the sense of the warmth was because then you felt, first you're not doing it out of malice, you're doing it out of goodwill. They want to help you. Yeah. So there's the benevolence one found, that you're willing to spend that much energy and time to stop your habits. And without even criticizing you for it. Just, no, this is going to cause you suffering, go there, and stay there, and hold it. And eventually just getting you to determine. And modelling sheer unreasonable commitment. Commitment and dedication that went beyond all reason. Doing these things, they're committed to doing the same structures, pujas, teaching occasions, day in, day out. Oh, you think this is going to go on forever? This, you know, and you thought they would do that as long as their breath was in their body. Just because that's where they were at. They were just that which, that's what it does. It stops and it returns. It's returning always back to citta, to the knowing, awareness, heart. You know, you've heard all this. But seeing it, modelling it, and seeing the modelling of the kind of committed resolve to do so. Somebody's offering that much of their time, their energy, and their love, you know, for you, you've got to rise up. You've got to, you know, you've got to pull yourself together with that. And so then you start to serve. And again, with very often very little information. So my fifth Rains retreat, and said, oh, you can go off, you can teach a 10-day retreat. They want somebody to teach a retreat. You go and do it. Okay. Nobody told me how to do it. Or do it. And then, oh, they started, they've got a little cottage up there. We need somebody to go and work on it, renovate it. So you can go. Okay. And of course, you know, I have no particular you know, training or skills in building work, you know, kind of literature is my thing. So getting this massive drilling holes in walls and in this, you know, tumble down dwelling up in Northumberland with the snow coming through the open door in the winter time, freezing cold, no heat. Do it. No information. Just do it. Find out. And the sense in which saying you've a chitta, you've a human mind that is capable of doing it all. You know, if you get that right, everything comes from that. All the details you can work out for yourself. I mean, there'll be trial and error, but that's what we want. We want you to restrain the conditioned habits of doubt, fear, agitation, grumpiness, disappointment, feeling, you know, fed up, resentment. Witness those, acknowledge them, drop them, and this way you're kind of working out all these tendencies just through them being activated. The doubt or the uncertainty or the why me. You know, you want to hear that voice. You hear that voice and then notice you can, once you see it, you can drop it, you can release it, and you must come back. The heart is made stronger by that process. So although one can certainly feel the sense of encouragement and, you know, you can do it, also you did feel pretty irritated by Ajahn Sumedho at times. Don't make it sound so damned easy. You know, and he said, Ajahn Chah, he said, a lot of time I'm seething with resentment and anger for Ajahn Chah. Because he was just whining, you know, boring, tedious, same old thing, sitting on this concrete floor, and listening to him go on about this, that and the other, and for hours on end, 3 hour dhamma talk, not unusual, 3 hours of talk. You sit there, you can't understand what he's talking, just sitting on this concrete floor. And he just gets so angry and resentful. And there's a child that grows a big smile. How are you doing, Sumedho? You can feel this heat. Nice fun, nice. Don't take it too seriously now, will you? You see all this stuff being sweated out. You know, all these. That was the system, really. Is you're welcomed in, a sense of person is warm and engaging, willing to take you on, and then you get pushed to get all this anger, resentment come out. And that's fine. Bring it out, you know. And he didn't imagine Charlie didn't mind if you hated him or not. He didn't bother him. And you have 60 or 70 monks hating him, you didn't bother him. Because he had no ill will. He wasn't coming from ill will. And as they say, you know, it doesn't matter if people hate you. What matters is if you hate them. That's the problem. It doesn't matter if people criticize you and mistreat you. That's no big deal. The worst thing is if you criticize and mistreat others, because then you've got the karma. Yeah? So it's okay. You know, you can do your, get your stuff out, your latent tendencies, your self-pity, your why me, your judgmental thing. Bring it out. Witness that. Contemplate it. It's a direct practice. And in a safe environment which allows that to occur. And at the same time, the teacher's just not going to get upset about it and will help, you know, you to see through that and return to this quality of knowing, timeless quality. And that was part of the sense of return, always back in the same place. But the place you get back to gets bigger. and stronger and more palpable. So you, that's where they're living. And in that place of non-attachment, you could say, put it in words, but with Ajahn Chah, you know, that place was very strong. It was so strong, you had like a magnetic effect on people. They just start to gather around and get pulled in. It was something like a magnetic quality to it. It was very dynamic and engaging. And just made it was a kind of much more softer space in some ways, but still very firm. And the firmness, because of the amount of stuff tangled up, mind states, that the energies had been released from these tangled up, confused, personal, historical stuff, which is, for most of us, is generally quite energetic. And they'd withdrawn the energy from that, and where the energy went was back into this presence. So the more they reduced their defilements, they got bigger. Their chitta got bigger and bigger and bigger. It's like, it's almost like. And of course, from a rational point of view, you can't understand this. Like, what is this? But from a direct experience, you knew this is why this person is so big and strong and vigorous, because all their suffering tendencies, or I don't know all of them, but a considerable amount of them, have been released, and the energy that we normally put into suffering isn't going there anymore. It's going back into this place, the here and now place, and it's always the same place, and it's strong enough it begins to pull you into it. And you're thinking, why did I make such a mess out of that? Why did I get myself upset about that? You know, it's like somebody wipes the dust out of your eyes and returns, and you return to that place. And this is the place where which begins to be the place where you return to through developing these, what I call parami, strengths, spiritual strengths. Resolution, of course, being the predominant one, because unless you commit and resolve, none of them work. They just collapse when the going gets rough. And so, you know, once the teacher has brought you in, you're feeling a little bit nourished and fed. And that was Jimmy Ajahn Chah's system. It really nourish and feed for a year or two, and then start to put the pressure on. He said, now you've got to actually get some muscle. And develop parami, and resolve, hold your ground, stay with it. And that resolve, patience, resolve. And that would be modelled and encouraged, both in the person did, and also in the situations which demanded persistent, committed patience, and bearing with it until you felt all these emotions come up, roll along, you feel helplessly swept away by these emotions, but just hold the ground and stay with it. These emotions would eventually lose their power and weight just through that alone. So you see something that's so direct. This is why it can cross cultures, because it's not really a verbal thing, it's not a Thai thing, it's a human thing. And clearly someone like Ajahn Chah could certainly, as he reached people, could find out ways that would bring them towards the place where they would be feel, you know, nourished enough to begin to make these personal things, to resolve to stay with it, and bring forth their strength. This is the sense of the Parami field, the kindness. And so with Ajahn Chah, it could be tough love. You know, it could be tough love. But he wasn't getting anything personal out of it. He was trying to do it for your own welfare. And they say, you meet all the senior monks, the Thayajans, you've been with him. And you talk about this, and they say, well, that Lumpur Chani, you see, when they mention Lumpur Chani, kind of, it's the tone changes. Something he did for them. Tremendous respect. And they're very different characters, these Thayajans. But they all get that sense of this is someone who took them on and met them as they were and nourished them and then caused them to develop their strength, send them off. Done wrong, he was saying when he was in talking down in Devon. He'd been going too long, and these people in, I think, Buriram, asked Ajahn Chah to send them a monk to, they wanted to establish a Bihara. So Ajahn Chah said, well, you've done wrong, you're here, you stay there. How long for? Just stay there for a while. Okay, no poor. And stay there for a rain's retreat. I've been here for a vasa. Stay a bit longer. Until somebody else is ready to come. Okay, so he stayed another year or so. Boy, is there time anybody else to replace me? Is there somebody better who could replace me? Not yet, just wait a little longer. They were waiting for 35 years for some. Nobody cared. This has been waiting for 35 years for a replacement. And after about 5 or 6 years, he started to just give up. And do it. That sense of somebody who could instill that in people. Where they have to meet and open and give themselves to the situation they're in. And this is really where we develop our parami. As we all recognise, we're aware of sights and sounds and numbers and years pass by and so on, and this is coming and that's going, and he's doing this and she's doing that, and da 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 da. We're aware of all that, it's very busy, it's kind of active, bubbling stuff. And this is the stuff that, of course, attracts our attention. This is what we feel we should deal with and work with. And most of us will try to do that as best we can. But of course, it can get very engaging. And you get drawn out into it. The parami comes from recognizing the mental currents that are going on in our activities, because the activities that we do, by being activities, whether it's working, managing, organizing, whatever we're doing, they're activities. They will bring out our activities, and most of our activities are sankharas, and these will be containing or carrying along certain defiled tendencies or personal tendencies. So they're bound to be drawn out in what we do. Yeah. And that's the deal. You know, either people get very responsible, or trying to make it all work. I mean, it's not these defilements are not necessarily, you know, evil, but they're imbalanced. Like we get very personally identified with our situation, or trying to make it work, or why isn't he doing as much as I'm doing, or she never turns up for this. And again, kind of a lot of stuff builds up around our duties and activities. And from the personal point of view, we're always trying to get it right, you know, so that this does work, and this is put away properly, and this person does show up, and she does tidy up her act, and one, this and the other. You know, we try to do it like that. Yeah. And then, of course, we get into suffering because of that. So that's the kind of, there's your meditation, or there's your bhavana, there's your palmi. Area. It's this bit that you're doing, right? On one level you're doing it as a worldly activity, but another level you're doing it to witness your tendencies, yeah? Witness your fault-finding mind, your I don't want to do this in the first place, half-hearted mind, or comparing yourself with others, or whatever. And this is the stuff I want to pull out of. Yeah? Now, rather than just say, well, I'll drop the activity, then I won't have to have all these nasty thoughts in my mind. I won't have to have this thing going, I'll just stop the activity. No, that's not the way you do it. You stay with the activity with all these defiled tendencies coming up. Right? So now you just keep aware of that and committing to that. And see where you can begin to, the jitta can begin to withdraw those latent cravings, latent ill will, latent self-forming tendencies, where we become identified with our duties, identified with our work, identified with what we think other people think of us, forming identities out of other people, she's one of those, he's one of those, you know. It's an identifying experience, I think. Meanwhile, in witnessing that, and, you know, holding the mind firm, you know, holding the mind firm, presence, awareness, firm, again, and you hold it against the flow of those. Doesn't mean they don't flow, but it's just you're able to hold a sense of witnessing and presence and groundedness, witnessing the mind going in its stuff, and not identifying with that. This is just sankharas occurring. And then no longer even getting upset about it, dispassionate towards it. When you get dispassionate towards it, the energy begins to fade and dies out. Even if you don't mind whether it's right or wrong, it's not important. It doesn't matter whether you're good at it or not good at it, it doesn't matter. What other people think of it is their issue, you know? You don't have to suffer in this way. And so the energy of the defilement withdraws and returns back into presence and awareness. And the beauty of it is it's very flexible. Unlike a meditation system where you have to have a pretty steady place, this is dynamic. You know, it's really using life itself in a way where you hold the activities of life within a particular template. This is here for me to develop some parami. This is here not for me to get it right, not for people to like it, not for it to be wonderful, but just for me to develop some parami, some commitment, some resolution, and some truthfulness, some witnessing. And so this quality stands steady while the klesa mind, the sankhara mind, runs out, and you just let it go and don't follow it. You hear the voices, the moods, and you've got this sense of presence that holds firm against that. And that's how parami gets developed. It doesn't get developed when the times are easy, it gets developed at those places where you're being tested and squeezed. Sometimes it's just boredom. Monastic life can sometimes be extremely, you get a lot of boredom. Same old puja, I mean, same, exactly the same song every day for, I don't know, years, same thing. And you get, first of all, trying to get it right, then you get interested in the Pali, and then you get interested in getting the tone right, the voice right, and then start complaining about other people not getting it right, criticizing, and you go through all this stuff, and then the tedium of it, and eventually it's gone. There's no tedium, there's no irritation, it's just empty. It's just, this is what happens. We sit, it's the same place we were yesterday. We sit, we breathe, sound comes out, and energy moves, passes. It's empty. And that's the essence of it, this repetition, until what remains is this difficult to express quality of citta. It's firm, it's open, it's clear, it's very solid, it's warm, but it's not passionate. And it resists the world. And the celebration of a teacher, someone who can do that, and who you, what you, how you relate, you know, how you form the teacher by your relationship, commitment to that, with all its off days. You know, certainly with Ajahn Sumedho, I'm not proud of the fact, it annoyed me. Because you often do something, but you've got no information how to do it. Well, you can figure that out. So, as a manager, it's a nightmare as a manager, and yet, it doesn't matter because we're not here to do that. It's here to bring forth strengths for myself, and also to lessen my critical anxieties. So then that's what it's about. Okay. And then you use that teacher to develop your parami. And it, certainly these people, I knew Ajahn Sumedho quite closely, as a child less closely, but they weren't hanging around either. You see the amount of energy and commitment and sheer diligence put into practice, total commitment. And with Ajahn Sumedho, when he was, obviously his energy is less now, but he's engaging with people and willing to engage with people, vast range of people, and so that same sense of the open door is there. You can walk in, and there'll be some crazy people who just let walk in, and you say, and you think, oh, so I think, what did you do that for? I mean, they're hopeless. You say, well, I'd like to experience being with a monk, so some seeds are there, so maybe in a future life that will bear fruit. God. I mean, that's generous, isn't it? you know, that they can use my presence so that at least sometime they've had the presence of somebody who listened to them in an open way. Who knows when that will bear fruit? I'm not asking for anything back. Maybe this life, another life. So you listen to that person for 2 hours of your day just so they could have that. Yeah, that's what you do. Okay. Yeah. And being in the centre of a monastery, Amavati particularly, very crazy, chaotic, and every day there. Morning puja, there. Morning breakfast, there. Mealtime, there. The river's there, just we're there. Yeah. Events of the day, but this is the main thing. We're here. We're here together. We're here. And this is where we gain our strength. So it's a very, very simple teaching. But then it's really direct holding of the heart and placing it till the heart recognizes beneath this person, you know, there's this potential for strength, and it's there for all of us. And then, so the teacher gives you back to yourself. You've lost yourself. You've thrown yourself away. And the teacher's the presence that helps you to return to your potential. This is why, you know, one celebrates. One feels touched, and that such beings have passed. You know, you've had whatever it was, the good fortune to be affected, touched, seen, connected to these powerful presences. So when we come back to our where we are now, you know, wherever you are now, is where you think you are, what your eyes see, what your thoughts do, and there's something else, something timeless. This is the reminder, timeless presence. It has no words in it. It's steady. It's present. It's available. It's open. Your thinking mind runs away from it. Your emotions stream out from it. What's your purpose here? Where's your ground here? Where's your here-ness here in all this? Consider, practice.